Nancy Tengler, Chief Investment Officer, Laffer Tengler Investments, and Dave Bonson, founder and managing partner of the Bonson Group, and his new book, There's No Free Lunch, 250 Economic Truths. All right, kids, welcome. So, I don't know, Nancy, did this Build Back America nonsense have much of a stock market impact? I mean, the market did get a little slumpy, but it didn't seem like anything huge. What's your thinking on it?
Well, I think it's a victory for rich people in the Democratic Party, who's now the champion of the wealthy, the unions, the trial lawyers, private equity. I mean, it's just I think the market's still waiting to see what's going to happen in the Senate. I mean, it breathed a sigh of relief when the corporate tax hikes were taken off the table. But there, you know, we don't even know what's in it, and we're finding out a great deal, including the fact that the CBO didn't dynamically score it.
Right.
So there is no reference point on what it's going to do to economic growth. But, you know, earnings, last thing I'll say about that is that earnings have been spectacular. 93% of companies have reported, and revenues have beaten by 2.9%, which is the number I'm most interested, because earnings can be somewhat massaged. But the year-over-year gain in earnings is 38.5%, and margins are at historic highs at 13% and seem to be holding. I was astonished in the third quarter reports at how well margins held up for many companies. So we'll see, Larry. There's not a lot of other alternatives. So, you know, we're still long equities with a focus on growth at a reasonable price.
David Bonson, I thought the Democrats were the party of the poor and the downtrodden. And here's Nancy Tengler telling us that the bill basically helps rich people. What do you make of that?
Well, they're the party of the poor millionaires and billionaires that need a tax cut in four blue states. So they're poorer than they were because they did see taxes go up a little bit on the elimination of the SALT deduction. And the reality is that some of these moments are kind of interesting for people like us that always want to be reasonable and civil. You know, every now and then, if someone you disagree with almost all the time says something you agree with, it's okay. And Bernie Sanders is the one who has this right about SALT, that this is a rank giveaway to the people that they say. Now, of course, I think they're wrong with their class warfare talk. But the point is, the elimination of SALT deduction that you guys did in the 2017 bill was right policy. It is unfair to well-managed states to subsidize states that are too big on tax and spending, and that's all that the SALT deduction change was meant to do. But this is a tax cut to the people that they say they want to go after. I cannot believe Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders would end up voting for this. I really can't.
Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders. Let me just think about that for a minute. When this Omarova woman from Moscow State University was testifying this Thursday, he had this great discussion going on. So Omarova called bankers a-holes, okay? And so she was cross-examined by some of the senators about that. But then later on, Elizabeth Warren was asked whether bankers are a-holes. And Nancy Tengler, she said, yes, they are. I'm sorry.
It's just remarkable to me, Larry.
I mean, you can't make this stuff up.
No, and they're angry about everything and angry at everyone. And yet Bernie Sanders has how many homes? I mean, he didn't get wealthy until he went to the Senate. I have no interest in their views on these issues because they don't even understand basic economics. And that's a problem. I mean, I think the country is suffering from that. So cheers to you, David, for writing a book about it. But I just, you know, when I wrote my last book, I looked at the Council of Economic Education, and the average adult gets a C minus on the a basic economics test, and an average high school student gets an F. And so until we fix that problem, and so through, you know, the work David's doing, I try to speak at Title I schools regularly. People, if they don't understand economics, they believe this stuff. And all the while with free money coming their way, the transfer payments have been humongous. I remember when we were all upset over the bailout package in 2008, and it was in the hundreds of billions, and now we're dishing out $2 to $3 trillion, you know, every other quarter. And of course we have inflation. I mean, we all know Milton Friedman was right. It's a monetary phenomenon. And so what you're seeing is, I mean, I got to just say this, Larry, I loved the headline in the Wall Street Journal on Thursday. President calls for inquiry into price of gas.
Yeah.
Biden, in a letter, alleges wrongdoing by energy firms, though experts see a lack of evidence. He's accusing them of, quote, illegal conduct aimed at keeping gasoline prices high. Meanwhile, he's cut the permit renewals in ANWR by 75%, shut down the pipelines, and is begging Saudi Arabia to pump more.
That's just where I was going. I mean, I was just going to go there because you're talking about the lack of economic education. And I don't know why the woke left, progressive left, does not understand David Bahnsen, they don't understand supply curves and demand curves. And the point I want to make here is microeconomics is just basic stuff. In other words, there's not that much disagreement between a Keynesian or a supply-sider over supply curves and demand curves. It's micro. Now, macroeconomics is a different matter. That's about politics and philosophy and ideology. I get that. But with respect to supply and demand, and here's this president going out there and blaming gas stations for colluding with one another, and that's the reason the price of gasoline has gone up, totally ignoring the supply and demand of oil. I mean, I don't know what to make of that. I mean, huh? Don't they know anything?
Well, first, let me say that any test that is reflecting an average score for adult economic education of a C minus is clearly grading on a curve.
Oh, God, it's wonderful. That's just wonderful.
The thing is, Larry, is that we have to decide what's worse. If President Biden really thought that and really had that kind of misunderstanding of economic basics, and as you say, supply and demand curves, or what I believe is the case, which is he doesn't really believe it, and it's rank politics and environmental extremism masquerading as economics. Mm. And that's what I think is the problem, is an ideological framework that is not rooted in science, it's not rooted in economics, it's not rooted in geopolitical reality. It is based in basically capitulating to a base that is removed from created reality, and it is almost laughable. I agree. It's laughable that we're talking about investigation into the oil companies that last year had to have 10 years of profits blown out from these lockdowns and had some of the worst capital erosion in history, and they fought their way through it. They protected their dividend. They optimized capital discipline, and then they get a new president who wants to shut down all of their efforts, and then they get blamed for high oil prices. Dear Lord, what is wrong with these people?
So, Nancy, actually, oil prices are falling lately. What do you make of that? Actually, it's so interesting. Yeah. Oil prices are falling a bit. Industrial commodities are falling a bit. Now, they've had big run-ups, I know, but they are falling a bit, and the dollar, on the other hand, is rising a bit. What do you make of all that?
Right. Yeah, I think a couple of things, Larry. I mean, we still think you want to be long energy for some time. We have a planetary decarbonization strategy that we hedged with oil.
Wait, run that by me again. Planetary decarbonization?
Yeah, it's a strategy to invest in metals and miners that, you know, are going to drive EV and clean energy. But being the cynics that we are, we hedged it with oil. And we think you still want to, you know, be long oil. But we have seen pretty active rate hikes by emerging market central banks. Mm. And so you're starting to see a slowdown that's creating, they're leading us, if you will. And that's, I think, going to create some global growth slowdown. And we're maybe starting to see the beginnings of that. And then the dollar has been strong, as you know, and that has an impact. But I don't think, even in spite of all of that, I don't think that the commodity story is over, because you do have to be mindful of the fact that we're throwing all this money at clean energy, and there's a supply problem, right? We've talked about this in the past. The greenies don't want you to mine, but they want you to drive an electric car that needs four times as much copper as a combustible engine car. So I think oil's going to bounce around in here, but until we see greater supply, and so far we haven't seen much, just, you know, a bit from OPEC, I think you're going to want to still be exposed to the sector somehow. And I think we'll see greater demand, obviously, in the winter, and that will drive prices back up again.
David, what you thinking about that? Because that kind of lends itself to the macro view in general.
Yeah, I don't think that oil prices are down that much. And I think that the fact that they only went down a couple bucks. And in fact, when there was this talk about China might tap some of their, you know, emergency reserves, it came below 78 and then it closed that day over 79 as non-speculative traders realized that was one of the dumbest news headlines in history, that China has emergency reserves to tap that can move the price of oil. It's comical. and even this
aren't they buying coal
on the president?
Aren't they buying? They're relying on coal, aren't they?
Well, they're certainly relying on coal for electricity production, which is again one of the great mysteries as to why the environmentalists are not pushing for natural gas as the greater solution, because we are not dealing with a question of natty gas versus solar. We are dealing with natty gas versus coal, and everybody knows what is the cleaner emitter, and yet they refuse to get on the natural gas bandwagon, which is actually the single biggest reducer of carbon emissions over the last 5 years, has been a greater use of natural gas. So sometimes I feel like I'm making the environmentalist argument for them, and yet they won't jump on the bandwagon of rational, thoughtful, sensible ways to move the needle over time. It is very frustrating, but I do believe, when you talk about the economics of it all, that it is a demand story. The demand levels globally of oil and gas, of people that are continuing to expand, that there's still a need for transportation, driving, all this stuff, we don't have enough supply to meet it. And when you talk about supply-demand curves, this is the one area where I'm willing to concede you're going to see elevated prices for longer than people think, other than the one thing that could bring down oil and gas prices, which is a significant recession, a demand shock. I don't know why anyone would be rooting for that.
Well, Nancy, there's $550 billion some odd in subsidies in this budget bill, which is essentially to cut back on energy, right? No fossil fuels, lots more windmills and solar. They don't like nuke. So I don't understand. If you want the economy to grow, you would want more energy, not less. You cannot grow the economy with less and less energy. So I conclude that the greenies and the woke crowd in general, the climate change fanatics, don't care about growth and indeed don't want growth. I mean, I think growth, because, you know, the government prospers when growth is bad or recessions are around. That's pro-government. And I think that's what they want.
And inflation, yeah. Well, I think a couple of things about that, Larry. They don't live in the real world. And so, you know, you get driven around, you live within the Beltway. None of this impacts you until you come up for reelection. And I think there's two really interesting, not related facts. One is that coal just hit a 12-year high. Mm. So that's going to put, in my view, it could put more pressure on Joe Manchin and in his inflation concerns to do the right thing, as we would say. But also, Biden's approval in states with really close Senate rates is about 33%. So that's Florida, Arizona. This is Dan Clifton's work, not mine. Georgia, North Carolina, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, New Hampshire, Nevada. I mean, that's critically important, because the places where real people live, they get this stuff. And, you know, I got picked up in Las Vegas and I asked, you know, it was booming, and I asked the guy how he was doing. He says, well, all you need to know is it cost me $20 to fill up my car last year, and now it costs me $60. And I think that's the way the average person sees it. And I drove back from Tahoe, and it was $6.29 for premium on the backside of the Sierras, a gallon. So this is going to have a profound impact. We all know inflation's a tax. And I think that you can't just accuse the oil companies forever. People see through that. And they know that Biden campaigned on shutting down the pipeline and, you know, going after oil. So,
now, David, I know you're not as worried about inflation, but to Nancy's point about the monetary excess, I mean, I don't see the Fed slowing down. They're pouring a lot of money in. Bank reserves continue to rise. I had Judy Shelton on the Fox Business Show yesterday, and she was talking about that. They're giving them money they don't want. The balance sheet is still expanding, and it's going to keep on expanding. And so are you not more worried about, I'm calling it Milton Friedman inflation, too much money chasing too few goods?
Well, I here's the thing. It's the chasing too few goods part that I'm worried about. And so I accept Father Milton's wisdom. It's a monetary phenomena. But the issue here is I don't accept that QE is ultimately a monetary phenomena. I think it's an asset price distorting phenomena. So when I say I'm not as concerned about inflation longer term out of these policies, I always want to make my real point, which is, because I'm being more critical of the policies. They want the inflation. I'm not saying, oh, don't worry, it's not inflationary. I'm saying they can't create what they want because they're pushing on a string, because we have stagnation that comes from this excessive indebtedness and excessive size of government. And when you move the Fed funds rate from 5% to 1%, you really move the needle. When you keep it at zero bound for year after year after year, you get no stimulative effect from it. All you get is financialization of the economy. And so my belief is that QE sits on excess reserves, but like Milton with Irving Fisher's quantity theory of money, the issue is velocity. And they're not getting inflation from the higher monetary pumping because the velocity is declining from a collapsing loan demand. And the lesson of the QE infinity we've been in lately is the same lesson from QE 1 through 3. The bond market is telling us. The dollar, by the way, is telling us. It's right now we have very significant inflation prices because we don't have enough goods and services to keep up with this growing demand coming out of COVID. And those are big problems. They're not things I'm not worried about. They're just different than long-term secular inflation, because I'm more worried about the Japanification of our economy.
Nancy, the Atlanta Fed GDP now has real GDP in Q4, 8.2%. That's a big number. And the inflation rate could be 7 or 8%. You could have 16% nominal GDP, total spending in the economy. That can't be good. I mean, it may look good. It's helping profits. No question about that. And profits are the mother's milk of stocks. It's helping margins. The revenues are terrific. But the after effects of this kind of blowout, I don't know. It's just something that's bothering me more and more over time.
Yeah, well, and I think we'll see growth decelerate in 2022, which is why we've been adding to growthier names, because we will get slowing and investors will be willing to pay up some for growth. But I think what's really interesting to me, too, and David touched on it, the lack of loan demand and velocity, money velocity. You know, companies don't have to borrow anymore. They just go to the bond market. And the pension plans haven't, and insurance companies have an insatiable desire to buy these bonds. CalPERS just announced that, this blew my mind, that they're going to borrow money to invest a little bit riskier because they're not hitting their targets, and to invest in higher yielding bonds. That then just gives corporations money to engage in share buybacks, and that's what's been putting an artificial floor beneath the market, in my view. I mean, I'll take it all day long. I mean, we're all thrilled with the market performance this year, but I think those when all of that sort of stops, the musical chair game, that's when we need to be cautious. And so we've increased the hedge that we have on our wealth clients account, and we'll continue to renew that going into 2022.
Did you say CalPERS?
Can we talk about that CalPERS thing for a second, Larry?
Yeah.
Because this is a big story. This is the most woke public pension in America that is now going to go on margin and lever up their portfolio to buy private equity. There's like so many sins involved in what they're doing in their own worldview. And CalPERS is margining up to increase the big, bad, evil private equity. I naturally assume that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are appalled.
Yeah, sure. Are they going to lever up and buy China, too?
Well, they already have a significant China exposure. And,
I know.
And when you look, I mean, I'm
this
heavily
is Larry
invested
Fink,
in Blackstone.
This is Larry Fink stuff.
Yeah, I think, but you're thinking of with this BlackRock hypocrisy. I think that these pension funds are right there, and some of them can't be called out for their hypocrisy on the energy on the China front because they're too busy being hypocritical on the energy front.
No, but it's okay to buy China, even though China's greatest championship tennis player is now a missing person.
Yeah,
but let's all invest in China because it's a wonderful place.
Yeah,
I mean, I have a problem with that. I was just talking to Marsha Blackburn about it. She wants to boycott the Olympics. She may not be wrong. I mean, she's a missing person, kids. It's not good.
Yeah.
Not good at all. So what's the outlook here? David Bonson, what are you buying?
Well, I really liked what Nancy said earlier, that we have this predicament going into 22 as risk asset investors where we know there's frothy valuations. The market has obviously shrugged off the entire year these issues about reconciliation bill, higher taxes, and now I think the whole thing goes to the Senate. The House vote yesterday was really kind of a non-story because there's at least four lines of demarcation that are dead on arrival unless somebody just completely capitulates. And so I don't understand how they get it resolved. Let's assume they get something resolved. It's not going to be a higher marginal rate on business income, personal income, or investment income. Markets like that. But valuations are very stretched in some of the more speculative things. And so what we're doing are the things that are going to have to be, whether people like it or not, the solution to this supply side problem. Industrials, materials, energy. We're buying the spaces that are cash flow generative. I like Nancy's idea of growth at a reasonable price. We don't want to overpay. So we can't buy the shiny objects right now. We can't go buy crypto and a lot of the high tech stuff just simply because it's more speculative in this environment. And when that froth wears off, we don't want to see 30% drawdowns. I think the stuff that is supply side to produce our way out of this price disequilibrium is going to be much more profitable next year.
And Nancy?
Our story hasn't changed much. Like David, we are overweight materials, industrials, and energy, but our biggest overweight is in technology. And, you know, there was a 13.6% real increase in software CapEx spend, and just in general, tech CapEx is now exceeding old economy CapEx. So we want to own the software providers in the cloud, cybersecurity. Palo Alto just turned in remarkable earnings. Mm. We're probably going to get forced out of that one due to valuation. But that's really where we're focused. We think that secular narrative in the cloud in particular is going to continue. And we're just early innings still, or mid innings. So we want to have some of that growth exposure. And we think that's pretty safe, although there's going to be some impact from this bill that may affect.
In the major sectors, Infotech is up 31% year to date. That's a big number.
Yeah.
Consumer discretionary up 28.5%. Of course, energy is up 44% because it was very depressed. And financials, banks are up 32%. Stuff that's not performing is consumer staples, or relatively speaking, and utilities.
Healthcare,
both around 7%. But tech, 31%. Last 52 weeks, tech is up 41%. So it's doing pretty well. I mean, America's still the tech leader.
Well, America's definitely still the tech leader, but I would point out, too, within some of those tech numbers, Amazon's up 12%, which is less than half of the S&P on the year. It's exactly half of the NASDAQ. Now you still have a big, Twitter's down 10. It's very dispersed right now, the results in tech. Mm. But you brought up consumer staples, and people keep asking me why I like the space, and they give the argument against it, and then I tell them that's why I like it. Because these higher commodity price inputs that have hurt margins, that's getting priced in if it isn't fully priced in. And yet the one space that has PE ratios that are basically in line with averages is consumer staples. Everything else is above historical valuation. So I think you have bad news priced in, good news not priced in, and I can buy it at a good valuation. It'll take a little while. It'll take some time for that to play in, but nobody in history has been able to compete with the pricing power of Procter Gamble, Pepsi, Kimberly-Clark. These names can keep, they're about as good an inflation hedge as you could ever buy.
And Nancy, just last one, interest rates?
The bond market is so artificially influenced by what the Fed's done. It's hard to make a prediction. We were at 2% for the 10-year at the beginning of the year. We're likely not going to hit that. I think we do see rates rise in the first half of next year. But if our thesis is correct and we get the sort of deflationary influence of technology spend improving productivity, then I think rates come back down. And Lisa Balsius wrote a great piece in Barron's about 6 months ago, can the Fed ever really raise rates again? If we get the kind of appointments that we think we're going to get, we may not see a big increase. And the bond vigilantes have been drowned by the Fed. I'm not really too worried about interest rates. But even if we get rising rates, the old saw that technology doesn't work in that environment is just not correct. It's not supported by the data. And those stocks also do well in an inflationary environment, if you go back historically. So we're going to stick with our bet on productivity improvers and semis and discretionary. And I'm going to let David take all the accolades for consumer staples because I'm underweight that group.
I don't see how you can have 3% plus break-evens, the five-year break-evens, and a 150 10-year. I mean, I just don't understand it. And whoever's appointed Fed chairman, I think it'll probably be Jay Powell, but they're going to put three or four woke members of the Board of Governors who are much more interested in climate change than inflation.
Yeah.
All right. Just think about that. Just
step
back from the day to day. Just think about that. That's the direction we're going. Sooner or later, interest rates have to pop. They just have to.
Well, in the long run, we're all dead. And the only two things that have been completely evergreen in every period that I've been able to make money on for the entire 13 years since the crisis is the belief that, this time the rates really are going to go higher, and time and time and time again they have not. and that, wow, margins really have gotten too stretched. Profit margins, and Nancy alluded to this earlier, their durability has been a sight to behold.
Yeah.
And the fact that the Fed cannot let this addicted society deal with a real normalized Fed funds rate, those are two things that I think are going to last for the rest of my life.
I thought you were going to say death and taxes.
Yeah, they're all related.
Nancy Tengler, David Bahnsen. Thank you, kids. Terrific stuff.